Welcome to episode 2 of All of Your Business with Michael Jonas. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents rise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. This episode brought to you by Unicorn Bake Shop, celebrating the grand opening of their first brick and mortar shop, February 2020. We believe delicious treats are good for the soul. On this episode, we've got Leslie Barber, owner of Grief Warrior, the company that sends healing products to a grieving person's doorstep when words aren't enough. All of Your Business is hosted by creator and executive producer, Michael Jonas.
Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
I'm so impressed with how you deal with grief. You're very open about it. And I think that's what we need to be.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that, about why you choose to be open about it and why you've created a business around it?
Yeah, absolutely. My husband died 4 years ago, and I didn't stop loving him the moment he died. I didn't stop being married to him the moment he died. He didn't stop being my daughter's father the moment he died. So to me, the reaction I had of sadness and sorrow and anger and anxiety and confusion made sense. It just made sense that grief is the yin or the yang, however you want to say it, of love. And so everyone would say to me, when are you moving on? When are you going to stop being sad? And what I found is that over time, I learned to live with it. I learned to carry it. It didn't go away. It didn't even decrease in its ferociousness. Mm-hmm. I just learned to carry it.
And what does that mean? You know, living with it, carrying it. What does that mean for you?
Yeah. So after Steve died, I'll just give one example. I was having multiple panic attacks daily. I'd never had a panic attack in my life. I learned later that in Eastern medicine, you carry your grief in your lungs. So the idea that I couldn't breathe and I couldn't get any air in made sense to them. It didn't necessarily make sense in our culture, but it really made sense in the Eastern culture. But over time, I would have fewer and fewer panic attacks, but they would come on as strong as they had the day after he died, when they did come on. And I'm 4.5 years out of my husband dying. And just about 2 months ago, I had a massive panic attack in Old Navy with this poor, you know, 17-year-old girl behind the register, because she'd asked me if I wanted a receipt emailed to me. And then she gave me my husband's email address. And I couldn't believe it. I've had millions of emails sent to me by Old Navy to my email address. And it just sent me to my knees. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't think. I couldn't process what was happening. So that just gives the example that over time, the ferociousness of grief stays with us because the love stays, right? You love somebody who's died forever. That doesn't go away. And yet over time, you learn to live with it. You learn to bring in joy and laughter and, and all kinds of other emotions in addition to the grief.
Sure. And, you know, let me tell you, I'm so happy that you're able to share this. You're willing to share this.
Yeah.
I think just talking about things is really important for us as a society.
Yeah.
We're often skirting, especially lately, these tough issues. Yes. Where someone says, I don't want to do that. I don't want to talk about that. It's too hard. But if you don't actually talk about it, you can't really heal. So there's that piece of that. The other thing that people may wonder, you know, you have an MBA, you have all sorts of business experience. You've decided to not relive your grief, but to turn your grief into a business. Mm-hmm. Someone may say, why would you do that to yourself? Why would I put that on myself? Mm-hmm. What is your response for that? Why is your business grief related, and how do you deal with that on a daily basis?
Someone has said that to me. I've had naysayers come to me and say, you will not get over your grief. To which I respond, I will never get over my grief. I am living with my grief. You can talk to people whose children or whose child or whose partner died 30 years ago, and you start to ask them questions about that person, and they sob like it was yesterday. We don't let go. We don't move on. We move forward. And when we move forward, we carry the grief with us. And that is hard for some people to navigate. So I have had people come to me and say, you know, isn't this making you sadder? Isn't this reliving it? Why do you want your identity associated with Steve's death? My identity is already with Steve's death, right? He's my late husband. He will forever be my child's father. That isn't going to stop. And when I can make life just a little bit easier for someone out there who's in the worst, darkest, most horrendous moment of their life, that makes my life better. Steve was the kindest, most generous-hearted, loving man I've ever met. By becoming Grief Warrior, by creating Grief Warrior, I'm living that for him. I'm giving what I hope I'm doing is giving other people an opportunity to have their grief acknowledged and giving people who love grieving people a way to say and do something that's helpful. That's positive. There's nothing I wouldn't want to do more. There's nothing that I would like to do more than to make life a little bit easier for somebody who's grieving.
I think that's excellent. I think it's needed, you know. And I know we've talked about this. You don't always know what to do. You don't always know what to say, right? So someone passes that's in your life, and you want to give the survivors, you know, flowers or cards or gift cards. Nothing really does it. Nothing really says, I'm here for you. I love you. I support you. And you even brought up when we were talking about this that flowers die. Mm-hmm.
They're dying when you send them.
Yeah, there's no furtherance. So tell me a little bit about your business. You know, I know you have the consulting aspect and then you have the gift box aspect. How do those things address grief in a better way for people, in a more tangible way?
Yeah. So the mission of Grief Warrior is to create opportunities for people to connect with someone who's grieving through products, so through my gift boxes, through methods of communication, and then eventually through community. And I created Grief Warrior because I wanted to change the way we think about grief in this country. It is, to me, a mission. It is a cause. This is much more than a business. And part of why I did that was because when my husband died, I was young. None of my friends had had a partner or a spouse die. They didn't know how to talk to me. They didn't know how to be with me. They wanted to fix my pain. And I get it. I wanted to fix my daughter's pain. My daughter was just shy of 7 when her dad died of cancer. And I wanted more than anything, I would have given all of my limbs to take her pain away. And, you know, I couldn't do that, Michael. I couldn't take her pain away. She had to feel that pain. And so I get it that my friends wanted to do that for me. And what I realized is that the people who got it, the people who could sit with me in my sorrow, the people who could watch me walk in circles, those were the people who had had a significant death in their life. They knew something I didn't know, right? It's like we're part of this club now, the worst, most fucked up club ever, but we're part of this club knowing what grief feels like. And so I started Grief Warrior because I felt like I wanted to make it a little easier. In fact, the step before Grief Warrior was that I became a professional coach. And in becoming a professional coach, my life, my purpose in doing that was that I wanted to help other women live their lives with intention and in the present without watching their husband die. Because that's what had happened to me. I was living everyone else's life before Steve died. I was living in the future. I wasn't living in the now. And when he died, it was like I was just going to blow shit up. I just blew it all up. And I blew up toxic relationships. I blew up, you know, relationships with family members. I blew up what I was doing for my work. I blew up where we lived. I just need everything to change.
Blew up as in you got rid of those toxic relationships.
Got rid of all of it. Got rid of all of it. And just decided I am going to stare my demons in the eyes. I am going to clear my body of the shoulds. Stop shoulding all over myself. And I'm going to do what I want every day, right now. And I still have to take care of my kid, right? Now I'm an only parent. I still wanted to make an impact in the world, but I was going to do it my way. And so I became a coach thinking I'd done all this work to get there. And I became a coach thinking I could help other women and men, but mostly I was focused on helping other women live the lives they wanted to live, because so many of us don't. So many of us live our partner's lives, our parents' lives, our children's lives. And it was in my coaching training that I realized I really wanted to focus on grief, that that was where I felt like our culture was failing in massive proportions, every single one of us, because every single one of us is going to have somebody we love die. It's the only thing we're guaranteed.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Can you tell me, listeners, how you got up, how you got out of bed, how you made goals? I mean, I commend you. You know, you're a strong woman. You got it together, right? But there's often things we don't see. So how do you parent your daughter after your husband passes? What do you tell her? How do you get out of bed and say, you know, I want to do this. I want to go there. I have errands to run.
Honest, it was a complete and utter shit show. There was absolutely nothing strong about it. Everybody would tell me I was strong. I was doing it because I had to. I had a little 7-year-old kid staring me in the eyes. You know, she had moved into my bed and she needed to be cared for. And I got up every day to get her to camp or to get her to school. And then I literally walked in circles. That was my way of processing. Steve had only been sick for 5 months. It was so fast. He'd had no symptoms. It was found accidentally, literally cancer everywhere in his body. We went to war, as they say, with cancer. And we threw everything we could at it. And the cancer ultimately killed him. And it was as if a tornado had blown through. It was so fast. So I was processing. I was unwinding every decision we'd made. My favorite place to be was in the back of my closet in the fetal position. People didn't see that. They didn't necessarily see that because they didn't come over to see that, right? Sure. And yet that's what grieving people are doing. They're either walking in circles or they're just functioning. And a girlfriend of mine suggested that I give myself a word for the end of the year, how I wanted to feel. Steve died in June. My word for the first year was survive. I wanted to be alive because I can tell you, Michael, I've been an optimistic, high-functioning, emotionally intelligent, glass-half-full person my entire life. And after Steve died, I did not want to be alive. I didn't necessarily want to be dead. I just wanted to be where he was. I wanted to be not alive anymore. It was so physically painful, and I was in so much despair. And so survive was my word, which is crazy, right? That would be my word, and it was my word, and I survived. And then my second year, it was okay. I just wanted to be okay. All my other friends are like, thrive, enlightened, you know, amazing. And I'm like, I just want to motherfucking be okay. All right? That's it. I just want to be okay. And my third year was alive. I felt dead inside. So I just felt absolutely wrung dry. And that was because I wasn't really living, right? I was throwing myself out of bed because I had a kid who needed me to. And the people I worry the most about, I'll have to be honest, are the people who have a significant death and they don't have a person or an animal to take care of. Those are the people we need to worry about the most. Because you find purpose. You've got to find purpose. And my purpose was keeping Emily alive for several years until one day I woke up and I was like, oh, I want to be alive now. And the rest is history. That was a couple years ago.
A couple things. I mean, one, I just want to know, you know, what did you say to Emily? You know, clearly she probably knew her dad was sick.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, I mean, children are smarter than we give them credit for, right?
Way smarter.
But, you know, telling a child that you're not going to see your dad again has got to be a tough conversation, any way you slice it.
Worst experience of my life.
So how do you communicate that? And then how does a mother live with a child who has that yearning or that lack of understanding or just an emptiness, just a void of not having her father there?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, talking about it frequently? Is it finding some sort of creative outlet? How do you sort of embrace that with her and figure out how to make that as positive as possible?
So Steve was sick for 5 months. We told her right away that he had cancer, and we had to find age-appropriate ways to explain that to her. And the doctors, nobody told me he was going to die. No one. I think they were all our age, right? They couldn't believe that he would die. And it wasn't until 10 days before he died that I realized he was going to die. And I was in denial. I mean, he was 6 feet tall, weighed 212 in March. By June, probably weighed 130. He was literally fading away in front of us. And it was awful. And my mantra, what I told myself, is that I could pay a therapist, I could engage a therapist to help Emily process her memories. I could not engage a therapist to create the memories for her. So I was not going to choose which memories would be relevant for her. She was going to be exposed to everything. Now, it was interesting because I had people of our parents' generation who came to me and said, you need to send her away. She needs to not see her dad dying. And I knew in every fiber of my being that was wrong. That was what our parents would have done. And I said, nope, she's going to see it all. And even to the point where she was there when he died, she wanted to see his body after he died. Kids are curious. They want to know. They want to understand. She said goodbye to him 2 days before he died. I was not sure when he would die. I knew it was going to happen fast. She wanted to do it alone. So I don't know what she said. She went in. She had a long conversation with her dad. And she got it. She got that he was dying. Now, did that mean that she understood he'd never come back? No. She was six. Of course she thought he was going to come back. So for probably a year, she raged. And I wish I was as thoughtful as you are, Michael, in terms of coming up with creative outlets. She and I just screamed bloody murder nonstop. Like, that's all we did. We just raged and screamed and cried. And I got her a grumpy cat stuffed animal that she could throw at the wall when she was mad, because there's so much anger, right? And so much anxiety. When she went to school in second grade, she called me probably 5 or 6 times a day, every day, because she needed to make sure I was still alive, right? So she had incredible anxiety that I was next, right? So parenting a grieving child is literally something we can wish on our worst enemies. It is torture.
Sure.
And it is so painful. And I think I really grieved Emily's daddy probably for 2 years until one day I was like, oh, shit, my husband died. Maybe I should actually start grieving my experience, like my husband.
Sure.
But as a mom, I just wanted her pain to go away. And yet I realized I couldn't do that. So I had to just hold her and scream it out with her.
Well, and I imagine there's the grief processing for her, but there's also, she's a child who's learning, who's socializing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're combining the two of those together.
Totally.
I think you mentioned that there is a camp that she went to or goes to for kids who have lost a parent to cancer.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, how you found that out, what that has been like for her to meet other kids who share a similar story?
Yeah, our grief counselor told us about these camps. There's one called Comfort Zone Camp, another Camp Aaron, and then Camp Kesem, which is for kids whose parents have had cancer, whether they've died or are still alive. And she's done all of them. And the goal, I think, for all three camps is to normalize. It's the same goal as the Dougie Center, where we went here in Portland for 2 years. It's to normalize. Because for kids that age, they don't want to be weird or different. They want, you know, they want what everybody else has. And they believe that everyone else has two parents, which we all know is not true. But that's what they believe. That's what the stories tell them. Also, at that age, kids don't comprehend that your parent could die. Mm-hmm. So there were times when Emily would come up to me and say, in a joyful way, Mommy, I met this new friend, and she doesn't believe me that Daddy died. Can you tell her that Daddy died? And I would literally have to look at this little 7-year-old kid and say, her father died of cancer. And this kid's just like wide-eyed, like, what are you talking about, lady? That doesn't happen. And that is really a challenging, like, heart-stopping thing to have to go through. It just is brutal. But kids, you know, they really get it.
What kind of, I would like to know more about Steve.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of person was he? What kind of husband? What kind of father? What was he interested in? You know, that's often the problem. I don't know if it's a problem, but the thing, too, someone passes and it's, you know, Steve has passed. Whereas maybe there's not a celebration of who he was.
Yeah.
So can you just tell us, you know, who he was, how he made you feel?
Yeah.
What kind of husband he was, what kind of father he was.
Well, and I'll start backwards, because his celebration of life that we had, we asked everybody to wear either Stanford clothing, because we were living in the Bay Area at the time and he was a huge Stanford football fan, or political clothing, because he loved politics and he was a high school government teacher. So we did try to really celebrate his life. It's very hard when you're talking about a 46-year-old who has a 6-year-old daughter to celebrate. It just is. It's just heartbreaking. And there's so much life not lived. And so we did our best with that. He had a memorial service at his high school as well. We had a memorial service there. And hundreds of students came. He was a high school U.S. history, an AP government teacher. He loved talking politics with kids. We lived in the Bay Area at the time. He worked in a school district where many of the kids were first generation, parents had never gone to college. He loved supporting them. I learned at his memorial service at the school that he brought sandwiches every day to school for the kids who didn't have a sandwich, and they could come in to his classroom and talk politics over a sandwich. I didn't even know he did that, because he left really early before I woke up. I did think he ate a lot of sandwiches, but I didn't really know why. And when I learned that, I just thought, yeah, he was that kind of man. He would do that for kids and not even tell his wife that this is why he was buying many loaves of bread every week. He would just act like it was for him. And that was just the kind of man he was. He was our rock. He was, I often describe us as a family that was a three-legged stool. And when Steve died and one of the legs was gone, Emily and I just face planted constantly. We couldn't figure out how to get the stool to work. It took us years, and we still work on it. To figure out how our family works without Steve. He was just a really solid guy. He was a tennis coach, and he took on a tennis team. at Newark Memorial High School in Newark, California, that had never won a single match in 17 years. And he pushed those, he taught those kids, he trained those kids along with his best friend, Matt, and they won their first match in 17 years. And it was like, well, they practically threw the guy a parade. It was so amazing. So he was just a really sweet, kind hearted, loving guy. And we miss him every day.
He sounds really like a great, great soul. And I love that story. And those are the stories that we don't often know about or we don't often hear. You know, those acts of kindness. He wasn't doing that for show. He wasn't doing that to get your approval. It was, those are kids that needed a conversation and needed to eat. And that's absolutely beautiful. And those are kids who are going to remember that. They're going to remember that they had that kindness shown to them and potentially pass that on to somebody else. So it's the act of kindness, actually teaching that and having that grow.
Yeah. He wasn't just one story on that. He wasn't a social media guy at all, because as a high school teacher, it's kind of dangerous to be on social media with all the high schoolers on social media. But so many kids wanted to come see him when they learned that he really was dying. And I couldn't allow that, because he wanted them to remember him as the vibrant, you know, teacher that he was. And so the week before he died, I created a Facebook page for him, and I spread the word. Anybody who wants to post something on there, and I promise you we will read it to him. In 24 hours, over 200 students, all the way from 15 years back, you know, until the present, had posted stories about Mr. Barber. And they, you know, we read every single one to him. And for years, students go on there when they want, especially because, you know, he never knew about Donald Trump running for president. And here he was, a government teacher. My husband had unbelievable respect for the presidency. He'd be rolling over in his metaphorical grave right now if he knew what we were dealing with. And students will literally send notes to me saying, I wish I could talk to Mr. Barber right now about, you know, politics. And I'm like, me too. I wish I could talk to him. He'd be losing his mind over what's going on. But he was just, he was just a really solid, loving guy. And it's, you know, Oprah always says there's a lesson in every experience. And I've had to give that one up, Michael, because I can't find a lesson in why Steve, why him, why cancer, right? He took care of so many kids. He loved his daughter. He loved me so much. He wanted to see Emily grow up. For years, I tortured myself with that question, and I've just had to drop it.
Sure.
Like, there's no reason. There's no meaning.
Cancer, you know, fucking sucks.
Fuck cancer.
And often really great people are taken from cancer.
Agreed.
And it's unfortunate. And I hope, and I know that this is something people say, but the time that you did have with him was remarkable for you.
Yeah.
And provided you, so there's not lessons in the death, but there's lessons in the life and who he was and how he lived his life.
And the lesson in what you just said is what came after him dying for me. His death taught me how to live. His death taught me that we're all going to die. And in this death-denying culture that we live in, we got to get over that, because I spent so many years saying, you know, I'll be happy when I lose 20 pounds. I'll be happy when I have $1 million. I'll be happy when I have a new car. And the reality is that none of that is going to make me happy, nor is there any guarantee I'll get there. I need to figure out how to find joy today. And it made me, the biggest lesson he's ever taught me has been that since him dying, he had so many things he wanted to do. I don't wait anymore. I do them now. I do them today. And I do me. And that's it. I don't do anything else. And I do it with love. And I do it with kindness, because that's how he would have done it. He's made me a much kinder person than I was before.
Well, and it also sounds like a good filtering of people and things to do is you don't have the time nor the joy when you hang out with people that are not good for you or not good for your life.
Yeah.
So how does this business come about, right? So obviously you're experiencing grief and you're a smart woman. You have an MBA. You've done business coaching, consulting. How do you go from that to I'm going to start Grief Warrior?
Yeah. I've always needed a mission in the work that I've done. So even though I have an MBA from Kellogg, I learned all the nuts and bolts at Kellogg, but the mission of how I function in a business environment comes from inside of me. It comes from the need for a cause. So my first business I started, we made prenatal vitamins. And the mission there was that so many women struggle swallowing pills, and I wanted a different way for them. So that was the mission, right? Make it easier for pregnant women. Then when I went to work at QuickBooks after that, I wanted to bring the voice of small business to a company that mostly hired investment bankers and consultants. I wanted to bring the experience of small business. That was the mission for me. And when I left QuickBooks to become a coach, as I was going through my coach's training, I realized that I do tell it like it is now. I don't sugarcoat. I can talk about grief in a way that is really uncomfortable for many people out there. And yet for me, it's my story. And it's the way I connect. And it sets me free. So I want other people to realize that grief makes sense, that grief is love. And if we all just realized that and stopped being afraid of it and stopped turning our eyes away from it, that we would be able to connect and feel like as grieving people, we belong in the culture or the support system that we had. And so I thought there's got to be a way to do that. Well, I don't want to necessarily market to grieving people, but I want to market to all the people who support them. Like you said earlier, we don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. We want to do something. We want to help. We're a good people who want to do something, but we don't know what to do. And so I'm handing to people on a silver platter a gift box that contains items in the gift that are things I would have liked in my darkest, most sorrowful days. And I've talked to hundreds of grieving people about what it is that they wanted during that time. It's acknowledgement, it's love, it's support, but it's mostly just acknowledgement and recognition. And that's what the box has in it. That's why I decided to develop this Grief Warrior box so that people who were supporting somebody in grief would have something to say or do. And then out of that also came the fact that I worked for a big company at the time Steve died. And I want everyone to have access to what I had access to when I worked at their big company. And I had very loving management. I want everyone to have that. So I'm launching grief coaching within corporations, as well as workshops that I've developed that will help companies understand how to acknowledge and how to support their employees in the worst moments of their life.
Sure. And talk to me a little bit about that. You know, someone is going through either a sickness or a death, and they're forced to be at work. They have to be there, you know, 9 to 5, 9 to 6, do whatever task, go to whatever meetings. They could be hurting. They could also potentially need to leave to take someone to a doctor's appointment, to pick up medicine.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that? Like, what do employers or corporations or anybody for that matter, what do we need to know for people who are working and grieving at the same time?
Yeah. We are completely misguided in this country when we think about grief in the workplace. There are studies that have shown that American companies lose almost $100 billion annually due to grief-related losses. So that is loss in productivity, that is absenteeism, and that is grief-related deaths and injuries. Now, why is that? Well, On average, we give people 3 days bereavement. So my husband died on a Sunday. I would have been expected back at work on Thursday. I can tell you, I was in no way, shape, or form to sit behind a computer, much less operate machinery or work in a factory, right? So you can see why the fogginess that you get when you're in deep grief, your brain is really trying to wrap its arms around what it's going through. Some psychiatrists even say that for 6 months after a massive loss, a massive death, that you're in a heightened state of stress. You're not actually even in PTSD for 6 months. So we expect people to go back to work and be as productive as they were before somebody they love has died. It just doesn't, when you say it out loud, it just doesn't make any sense. And yet it's how companies and our laws work. And so because of that, corporations are seeing huge losses and they're seeing it right under their nose. And I just can't understand why. And when I've dug into it with HR people, and I've now interviewed dozens of HR people on this topic, they say, well, Leslie, HR doesn't have HR. We're human. We don't know what to say or do just like all the rest of you, mm-hmm. right? And that's just wrong. Companies could actually create a competitive advantage for themselves if they learned how to not only take care of their employees in the best moments of their lives, like maternity and paternity, but also in the worst moments of their lives, like bereavement. And you could actually create a significant competitive advantage for yourself if you were willing to just acknowledge what's going on and give people space. And that isn't happening in many, many companies. And that's something I'd like to change. I want to be a part of the conversation that is trying to change that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of All of Your Business featuring Leslie Barber of Grief Warrior. We're going to take a moment here to thank our sponsors. Naive Melody Vintage Shop. Located in historic downtown Oregon City, Naive Melody is an ever-changing, eclectic assortment of all things vintage, cool, beautiful, and strange. Find out more at naivemelodyvintage.com. Today's show is also brought to you by Mighty Epiphyte. They can help your business grow, get certified, and increase impact. Visit us for more information at mightyepiphyte.com. And now back to our conversation with Michael Jonas and Leslie Barber.
In our society, we have a lot to change with things like this, mm-hmm. with women going back to work after having a baby that are not ready, people needing longer family or medical leave time, mm-hmm. or not having it, having the option of having that, mm-hmm. What you're talking about, healthcare. I mean, yeah. The list goes on and on.
It's huge.
What I'm wondering is, what do companies do when they have someone at work who is going through this? Do they see that person as not productive and they potentially fire them? Do they try to talk to them? Do they misconstrue what they're going through and say, oh, maybe you need a raise and that'll make you happy? Or, you know, what is the way that people are communicating about this at work? Or maybe an employee has decided to not talk at all, to put on this fake, I'm okay, mm-hmm. in order to meet, you know, unrealistic productivity standards.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer is yes. I think all of those things happen in the workplace. What is one string that I find frustrating that I think we can address is that most companies leave it up to the manager. So they say, oh, HR will talk to the manager and get the manager to support you. Now, if you have a manager that's maybe had a death in their family and understands a little bit more, has experienced grief, that manager may be a little bit more willing to work with you to find ways for you to take time off or to help with job sharing or to help with flexibility, allow you to work from home or whatever it is that works for you. Maybe even find you some money from the company to support funeral services or grief counseling. If you have a manager that is highly uncomfortable with emotions, as many managers in this country are, You have a very different experience. And I saw this firsthand at the company I worked at. My VP was incredibly loving and kind, helped me find a vacation donation policy that enabled me to take time off paid. And she was willing to be very flexible. She helped me sit behind a computer in an office with a closed door. I was very lucky and privileged in what happened with me. I have a friend whose husband died early last year, same company, different manager, extremely different experience. She was shoved into and pushed to come back. She ended up, by the way, being out twice as long as I was, because my manager acknowledged, my manager looked me in the eye, told me she would be there. She cried with me. When I came back to work, my whole team cried with me. This other manager was not doing that. And as a result, pushed my friend into further darkness. So we can't adjust for every relationship. What we can do, though, is standardize and bring equity into the grief process. And that's what we don't have in this country. We're starting to do that with maternity and paternity, right? There are laws that say you have the right to take certain amounts of time off. It is not enough, but it is way better than 3 days for bereavement. And in my humble opinion, what your body goes through with grief, having had a baby, I feel like I can say this, it's as significant as when I had a baby, right? It's as significant. And so because of that, we should have the ability for everyone, not just the privileged few and not just the ones with great managers. Everyone should have equity in being able to take care of themselves in grief.
Yeah, I think that's great. And as I said earlier, I mean, we have a long ways to go. You and I both, we probably bang our head against the wall asking, why are we not doing things that make sense? Why are we not doing things that are logical?
Yeah.
Right? Why are we going in circles?
Yeah.
And this relates to everything, you know, fair pay for women, fair pay for women of color.
Absolutely.
You know, asking people at a workplace how they're feeling.
Yeah.
If someone has to go to a doctor's appointment, they shouldn't be fearing that they can't go to the doctor's appointment. You know, and you're right, though, that what happens is when a company or business actually treats their employees better, you know, they actually get better productivity and they get trust.
Loyalty.
And that's someone
retention.
Who wants to stay there. And that's someone who wants to give to the company and be better for the company.
Yeah.
And some of these things, I mean, they're so easy to do.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you're going to be great at this, and I'm excited for having, I think every company should have some sort of policy program about bereavement. And the answer is not just to, you know, oh, we don't talk to her. She's going through a tough time.
Yeah. We're starting to see a little bit of a change. And Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook, whose husband died 7 weeks before mine did, as the COO of Facebook, she was able to change their bereavement from 3 to 5 days to 20 days. It's something, right? CEO of MasterCard followed suit because he had had a child die. I just wish that we would do these things without having to be personally experiencing the death. Like, this is the right thing to do. We should be taking care of people when they are going through their worst moments, just like we take care of them when they go through their best moments. So absolutely. And you know, I acknowledge that there is grief from so many different, you know, experiences, job loss, divorce, you know, estrangement, all of those things. My focus with Grief Warrior for right now is on the death of the closest people or animals. So it could be a significant pet loss. It could be, you know, a significant death in your family or a dear friend, but really having to focus in on that. And that's what I think we should be doing in corporations as well, taking care of people in those moments.
And you're doing it.
Thank you. Yeah, that's what Grief Warrior is all about, is trying to give supporters a way to show up for the people who are grieving, try to build community around people who are grieving by connecting them to other people with similar losses, and then enabling their workplace to support them. It's not as scary as we think it is. grief is because you love somebody fiercely and then they died. That I want them to be sad. I want everyone to be sad when I die. So heck, why wouldn't, right? I mean, come on. I want to have had an impact on people's lives so that when I die, people are sad. I want a lot of sorrow. Like, I joke, I don't want a big party. I want you all crying in your soup. Like, I want everyone sad. And that's because I want to have made such an impact and have so many people love me that when I'm gone, that they'll miss me. And that makes sense. And so grief, that's how grief is for all of us. It's not something to be afraid of.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate, you know, your candor, but also your strength. And I know that people told you that you have strength. But what I'm getting at is you've chosen to have a purpose-driven business.
Yes.
Based on everything that you've been through. And it carries you through and through. So, you know, today, tomorrow, the future, you're thinking, how can I be about love? How can I lift people up? How can I bring community together? And I think that's a really great thing. And I think that tying that to business is an extremely great thing and extremely beneficial for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I was taught in business school to care about sales and revenue and profits, right? But when it really comes down to it, what works for me, and they're the same thing, is caring about how many grieving people are getting acknowledgement because of our box, how many grieving people are having an easier time in their workplace because of the work that we're doing, how many grieving people are learning how to carry their grief and move forward with their grief because of the grief coaching I do. That is what will bring an ongoing concern for the business, but that is what will bring change, and that is what will bring impact, and that's really what matters.
So we have 5 questions we ask every guest.
Awesome.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So the first question is, if you weren't doing this business, so if you didn't have Grief Warrior, what business would you be doing?
That's a really good question, Michael. But I have to tell you, like, I am living it. Grief Warrior is a cause. It's every fiber of my being. It is a mission for me. It is a choice for me. And it's a calling. If I weren't doing this business, I probably would be traveling the world, seeing the sights. There's lots of places I want to go to, but I can't imagine doing another business because this really is, this is everything. This is what I'm meant to be doing.
That's a great answer.
Thank you.
If you had to have, or not had to have, but had the option of having one celebrity to be a business partner with for this business, who would that person be?
Well, the moment you said celebrity, of course, Oprah comes to mind.
I love Oprah.
Because I love her so much. Oprah was my professor in business school. She taught at Kellogg.
What?
Yes. She taught at Kellogg for 2 years.
I am so jealous right now.
I have an A on a paper from Oprah. It's one of my claims to fame. I'm so proud of it.
I love bread and I love your paper.
Exactly. And you get a car and you get a car and you get a car. And she tells it real. So if I could partner with somebody, Oprah or Brené Brown, I have to say, both of them get in the ring. Both of them have inspired me to look inside my own heart and soul and live the way I'm supposed to live, live my life, and do the work that I know can help people, even with the naysayers. So I think I would choose Oprah first, and then if she's not available, Brené Brown.
Not a bad second.
Yeah,
Brené is
exactly.
Wonderful.
I love her.
If you could form a squad of people to work with, you know, bounce ideas off of, kind of a fan club, who would be in that squad? So whether they're past or whether they're alive, who would be there? Oprah, Brené.
Oprah and Brené, of course. I'm a big fan of Glennon Doyle. I think she talks so real about life and living unexpectedly. And she talks about grief. I love Liz Gilbert, whose partner died 2 years ago, Rhea. She has inspired me so much on social media in the way that she talks about grief, how honest she is. And then I have to tell you, I have just had so many inspiring widows and widowers that I have met since Steve died, who have shown me what living is, who have shown me how to be strong by crying, by being vulnerable, by falling on the ground, by bringing ourselves to our knees. I would pull all of them. I'm thinking of Jeannie and Christina and Tiffany and Sandy and so many more who have inspired me and who have lifted me up, even in the darkest moments of their lives. So I think those are the people I would pull together. And of course, my daughter, Emily, who has opinions and thoughts on pretty much everything I do. So she'd have to be in there, too.
That's excellent. Maybe Gail King, if it's a road trip.
Oh, Gail King, sure. Well, I don't know. I kind of want to be Oprah's best friend. So I think Gail may need to stay home. Sorry, Gail. Love you. Mean it. I'd probably bring my brother Holcomb, too. He's my design eye. He's got such a good flair. So I would bring Holcomb.
You guys could travel. Oprah would be like, I'm going on a road trip with Leslie.
I'd love it. Let's do it.
So when you reach a certain level of success, and I think you're successful just being who you are, doing what you're doing, right?
You.
But when you reach this level of success, that's this unimaginable level of success, or this level of success that you feel, wow, I've made it. What do you buy, or what do you splurge on? How do you treat yourself?
So you're associating success with money, right? Can I challenge you on that?
Yeah, I would love for you to.
I don't associate success with money anymore. I just don't. I associate success with a peaceful heart and with peace of mind around money, with a relationship acknowledging that money is freedom, and I acknowledge that, but that money cannot bring any sort of success or happiness. To me, success is living my life every day. Success is if I died tomorrow, that I will have felt like I had done love, and that I will have felt like I was loved, and that I loved with all of my heart. And that's my word for this year, by the way, is love. And I feel like that is what success means. So when I achieve that, maybe I'll go to an ashram. I've always wanted to do that. maybe I'll go see the pyramids in Egypt, which is the beginning of civilization, a civilization that looks very different than what ours does now. Those are the types of things that I want to do to fill my soul. And that's what success means to me. I'm not looking for a dollar amount. I'm looking to bring a little bit of joy to people's lives in the worst moments of theirs, and then to bring a little joy to my life as well. And that's it.
Well, I appreciate that. And I agree. Success isn't always about money. You know, there's so much more. And you could have millions and you could feel unfulfilled. You could feel like you have a void. You mentioned earlier, it really is love that life comes down to, mm-hmm. and what you do with love and how you share love.
Look, I grew up in Silicon Valley, right? I've known billionaires my whole life. I've not known any happy billionaires. I've known very sad millionaires and billionaires. It does not bring any sort of joy whatsoever. In fact, I think it brings the opposite to a lot of people. So like you said, this is, to me, success is when I don't feel the demons in my heart anymore, when I feel that my body feels clear, that I'm living my truth. That's success.
One more question.
Yeah.
Who is a local or national business that you admire, that you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah.
So you see them and you go, wow, I really love what they're doing.
Yeah. So I have to say that I think I want to give a shout out to a couple of nonprofits that are doing really important work. The Dougie Center, I cannot praise them enough. They held me and Emily in a time when we really needed it, and they serve grieving children and their families. I've also come to learn of a new organization to me called Michelle's Love, and it's a really lovely woman, Andy, whose best friend died of cancer, and she raises money for single parents who are going through cancer treatment. I just want to kiss the ground she walks on. Like, that she pays rent for people. Like, that is, we were so lucky that I had a good paying job when Steve was sick. It could have bankrupted us. And to think that I could be an only parent with little kids going through cancer treatment, that's cruel. And Michelle's Love takes care of them. So I just have to shout out to those two, because to me, they're really doing, you know, what a lot of us call God's work. They're really doing that kind of work, and I praise them enormously.
Well, thank you for that. It's been absolutely wonderful talking to you.
Likewise. And
thank you for all the great work that you're doing.
Thank you for being a part of it. I really appreciate it. I'm part of why Grief Warriors here is because I partner with amazing people like you. So thank you so much for being a part of Grief Warrior.
A very big thank you to Leslie Barber, owner of Grief Warrior, for sharing her stories with us today. For more information on Grief Warrior and all the amazing things that they do, go to www.agriefwarrior.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, Naive Melody Vintage Shop, Mighty Epiphyte Consulting, and Unicorn Bake Shop. Unicorn Bake Shop, celebrating the grand opening of their first brick-and-mortar shop on Saturday, February 29th, 2020. Mention this podcast at the new store and they'll give you a free cupcake. There's more information at unicornbakeshop.com. And of course, a big thank you to you, our listeners. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite streaming service, share the episodes, and visit us at allofyourbusinesspodcast.com.